I am honored to introduce to you our speaker this evening, Dr. Francesca Aran Murphy. A native of Great Britain, Dr. Murphy seems to have spent her life traveling back and forth across the Atlantic. She was born in London. As a child, she studied at PS 41, not far from here in the West Village. Then later at the University of Manchester, then the University of Southern California, and finally at King's College, London, where she earned a PhD in theology. She has taught at a number of institutions, including St. Martin's College, Aberdeen University, and the University of Notre Dame, where she now teaches systematic theology. Her particular research interests include theology and the arts. She has been quite a prolific scholar, so I can only provide a few highlights of her work. Her books, Christ, the Form of Beauty, and Art and the Intellect in the Philosophy of Etienne Gilson, would be of particular interest to all of you here, as well as a number of essays which deal with the question of beauty. For example, Hans Urs von Balthasar, Theological Aesthetics as a Gateway to Systematic Theology. In layman's terms, I believe that means beauty is a gateway drug to God. Let's find out if that's about right now. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to Dr. Francesca Murphy.
Thank you very much for inviting me. My talk is called Beauty in the Spiritual Senses, and my first point is called Proposing an Analogy for the Spiritual Senses. Aesthetics, as you probably know, is the science of perception. Can you hear me at the back? The word aesthetics comes from the Greek aesthanomai, which means I perceive. Aesthetics became a science in the 18th century when German philosophers especially connected the science of perception to the science of the beautiful, specifically relating perception to perceiving beauty. Perception is experiential as distinct from cognitive. That's how they understood it. When Hans Urs von Balthasar wrote about theological aesthetics, the point was to ground theology in experience. Back in the late 18th century, Immanuel Kant, had written three volumes, The Critique of Pure Reason, The Critique of Practical Reason, and finally, The Critique of Judgment. The last of the three, The Critique of Judgment, was about aesthetics. So you begin with The Critique of Pure Reason, which is about metaphysics, then you have The Critique of Practical Reason, which is about ethics, and finally, in the Critique of Judgment, you have aesthetics. The idea that it seems to be that metaphysics comes first, and then ethics, and then aesthetics comes last. So first you decide what is true, and then you do some ethics, and finally at the end of the day you add aesthetics, like cherries on the cake. This makes aesthetics, and in particular the experience of beauty, a kind of optional add-on. No matter how important it is to Kant and to those in the Kantian tradition to have sublime experiences of the starry skies above, it is a last touch, which is somewhat superfluous to what we think about truth and goodness. In this tradition, the aesthetic does not condition our experience of truth and goodness all the way down. Love, beautiful sights of waterfalls, gazing up at the starry skies above, is a kind of finishing school for the Kantian personality after it is nearly fully formed by intellectual and moral means. This implies that the experience of the beautiful cannot fundamentally affect what we think about truth and how we act morally in the world. This is untrue to life. In actual life, we are already in the midst of all kinds of practical projects before we consider speculative questions. And what kinds of things we are up to, what kinds of things we are doing, conditions how we consider these speculative questions. What we are doing with our lives, what we love, affects what we can possibly think is true. In actual life, the images that are in our minds, the images which we are drawn to and desire, the images which we find repulsive and flee, have a controlling effect on our actions and so on our judgments about truth. The great moralists like Plato tell us that our minds and intellects ought to control our imaginations. But these same moralists use images and allegories of great beauty, like the allegory of the charioteer in the Phaedrus, to urge us to use our intellects to control our imagination. So it is somewhat circular, but not in a vicious circular kind of way. It is in the capture of our imagination by dynamic images that we are converted and change our lives. And it is as a consequence of such conversion that we subsequently attempt to reform our imagination. So when von Balthasar wrote his great trilogy, he turns Kant's trilogy upside down. The theological aesthetics comes first, and then the theodrama, which is about ethics, and finally the theologic, which is about truth. So on this view, we need to consider the quest for truth as in some way founded, shaped by our moral personae and how we act in the world, and our moral personae is founded and shaped by our experiences of beauty. What we call beautiful is going to affect how we behave as moral actors, and what we are able to say is true or false. So that is the theory of it. In fact, now, theological aesthetics is a thing. There's a sort of niche market for it. It's very common for people to have opinions about topics like theological aesthetics without having any correlative experience whatsoever. A great deal of talk in theological aesthetics is unrelated to any corresponding experiences, because you can talk about it a lot, talk about it all the time. When we were in graduate school, a friend of mine composed a little piece of theological aesthetics for his college Christian newsletter, in which he quoted Jared Manley Hopkins' famous lines, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil." The article proposed that there is too much busyness in our lives and we need to notice the shining of shook foil in order to experience the presence of God in the world around us. My friend commented to me after it was published, in his typical self-deprecating way, that he did not spend a lot of time looking at silver foil or any other kind of household object. And like many people, he had the humility to realize the extent of the disparity between what he was talking about and his own experiences. So I'm saying that there's kind of a paradox, or I don't know, irony perhaps, that many people talking about theological aesthetics don't actually base it on any experience at all. They just talk about it. The same can happen when we talk about spiritual senses. Even more easily than talking about poetry and its connection to daily life, we can talk about spiritual senses and their objects without linking it to any correlative experience. The idea of the spiritual senses goes back to certain so-called Platonizing biblical interpretations made by the early church fathers. It comes back to an allegorical reading of the Song of Songs. The Songs of Songs is the most deeply aesthetic book in the Bible, containing perhaps its greatest poetry. Consider Song of Songs, chapter 1, 2-4. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your breasts are better than wine, and the fragrance of your perfumed unguents is better than all spices. The fathers performed an allegorical reading of this erotic text, reading it as a narrative of the encounter between Christ and the soul. Most people read these patristic commentaries on the Song of Songs, and most of them talk about them. They have not experienced the encounter with Christ as being like the encounter with a fabulously perfumed body. It becomes a matter of words. It may be gorgeous words, but they are still words which don't really correspond to any experiences we have ever had. In one of his sermons on the Song of Songs, Gregory of Nyssa interprets the story of the Song of Songs like this. The Song of Songs sets out for us matters that evoke a desire for the contemplation of transcendent goods. At the same time, it fills our soul with grief as it creates despair of our grasping the incomprehensible. For the purified soul does not yet seem to have laid hold on what she seeks. Filled with sweetness by the apple tree's fruit, she entered the treasure house of gladness. Disposed and ordered by love, she is sustained by perfume after being clothed by apples. So what happens here is that the physical sights and tastes and smells of the song are interpreted as corresponding to spiritual objects. In this Platonic reading, tasting with our tongues becomes the pure form of tastiness in God, which is experienced by our soul. Smelling with our nose becomes the aroma, the perfume of God. The joy of erotic encounter is transmuted into the joy of the soul in knowing Christ. And this reading about what we have to say about the spiritual senses, reading about spiritual senses, leaves me feeling like I will have to be dead and in purgatory for about 50,000 years before my spiritual senses are going to kick in and replace my actual physical senses. It seems like we have physical senses, and we may have spiritual senses after making some kind of internal transition, such as happens to heroes of fantasy movies, where the hero is in an accident and scientists replace his body with a robotic body, which enables him to become invincible and perform superhuman action man feats. In the end, the monster turns on the scientists who operate him and destroy the Frankensteins as well. Seems as if I would have to become a spiritual Frankenstein's monster for me to experience these spiritual senses, because it doesn't connect with anything in my actual experience. How can we think about the kind of internal transition we're supposed to make from experiencing physically to experiencing spiritually? It seems as if we would have to be engineered into something we are not, like the superheroes, or transition into something we cannot imagine ourselves as being, like caterpillar to butterfly. From reading the fathers like Origen and Gregory of Nyssa talk about the spiritual senses, it seems as if we are either monks in an Orthodox icon and we have spiritual senses, or we ourselves in the 21st century America and we do not have spiritual senses. And the only things we actually like the smell and taste of is pizza and cheeseburgers. So the spiritual senses sound like a great thing for a theology graduate student to write about, or for Christians to talk about over beer and pizza, but it does not sound like anything I could ever feel or taste or experience in my actual body as it is now. So the purpose of my talk is to propose an analogy for the emergence of the spiritual senses. I want to talk about the development of our regular aesthetic faculties and try to think about an analogy for the development of spiritual senses. I want to say there is an analogy for the growth of the ability to exercise the spiritual senses in the maturation of our tastes. You may say there is no analogy. You may say it's impossible to build one on top of the other. You may say there's no analogy. You may say it's impossible to build one on the other. And you're wrong about the first objection, but right about the second objection. I'm not saying it's the same thing. I'm not saying that one process is built on the other. One process cannot be built on the other. Spiritualizing the senses is not just improving the aesthetic education of a person. It is not just extending further what is already there. If the development and maturation of the spiritual senses was built simply on educating the physical senses, then every saint would be a connoisseur of all the arts. They would be a gourmet, a connoisseur of all the arts. You would have to be a connoisseur of all the arts before you could even be a saint. If the spiritual senses were purely and simply built on the physical senses and the one purely and simply transitioned into the other. This is not the case. One can be a saint and tone deaf, or I certainly hope so. Many of the saints are hopelessly insensible to the arts. So it cannot simply be the case that the maturation of the physical senses is just equivalent to the maturation of the spiritual senses. There must somewhere be a different trajectory. And I accept this. So, however great the analogy is, there is a sudden and total cutting off point between the maturation of the capacity to enjoy physical beauty and the beginning of the capacity to enjoy spiritual beauty. The reason is simply that the spiritual senses are planted and initiated by the grace of God. It is not something which happens naturally by our own efforts. The saint and the human being who is sensitive to great art are different because sanctity is built on the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, and the Spirit flows where it lists. But I will still argue there is an overlap. The grace of the Holy Spirit can infect a whole culture and change its way of seeing. I'm thinking of how, after centuries of Christianity in the West, the crucifix came to be seen as an object of beauty. No ancient Greek or ancient Roman could have applied the word beautiful to an image of a man bleeding to death on a cross. As the world sees, a man bleeding to death on a cross is ugly and horrific. Everyone's senses, everyone's taste for the beautiful has been altered by the baptism of the Western imagination by Christian civilization. What we might naturally call beautiful has been changed by the alteration of the meaning of suffering and death which the crucifixion brings about. In some sense, our senses have been spiritualized by the past 2,000 years of Christian history. An initial spiritualization of our senses has occurred. The crucifixion is the most extreme example of a massive revolution in aesthetic sensibility which Christianity brings about. Eric Auerbach wrote famously about the tears of the fishermen. The gospel stories of Peter going out and weeping after he learned that he had betrayed his master 3 times before the cock crowed are the first examples in Western literature, according to Auerbach, of the tears of a fisherman being taken seriously and not light relief. Peasants are simply light relief in ancient epic. The heroes of the Old and New Testament are often shepherds, old crones, peasants, even a carpenter. To attend to their stories is to be changed person from the readers and listeners who heard the epics about the great kings, Odysseus, Achilles, Aeneas. Great epics of the pre-Christian world are about kings, great figures. It's a complete change, a complete spiritualization of the imagination to think these people are at all important. To be a representative of the human race in ancient pre-Christian literature, one had to be a king, or at least a prophet. The representatives of the human race in the Old and New Testament are largely ordinary peasants, ordinary working men. The fact that such characters people our literature today indicates that our senses have been spiritualized. It's only one example of the spiritual senses coming to inhabit our physical senses, changing the experience of beauty by changing the objects which we would call beautiful. It's an example of spiritualization of the physical senses. The spiritualization of the physical senses can affect the whole culture. It can be said that most people do not think the crucifix is beautiful. They're simply inured to the crucifix, it could be said. The crucifix is not what most people would choose to contemplate if they wanted to look at something beautiful for half an hour. This is because most people's senses have not been educated to become spiritualized. In terms of what most people choose to feast their eyes upon, most people find what Christianity calls beautiful ugly. So the crucifix is the key example of Christian taste in art. Let me give another example which shows how Christian taste differs from contemporary secular taste. If I tell a class of theology majors that the ancient Greeks only found beauty in young athletic boys, but nowadays, because of the spiritualizing influence of Christianity, we find beauty in a wizened old woman, these theology majors know exactly what I mean. They can draw directly on their experience to see how there is beauty in a wrinkly, shriveled old person. They think it's just a truism, but our culture has changed our way of seeing. Our perception has shifted so much that they can see a wrinkly, hunchbacked old dame as beautiful. And they think such a cultural shift really has taken place. But at the same time, think of a great Manhattan movie, which is Woody Allen's Annie Hall. One of the great movies of the past 50 years, beautiful shots of Manhattan. In that movie, the young Diane Keaton and the youngish Woody Allen, are they like goths, enjoying the lights of Manhattan? Their one great fear is to become old and ugly. In Annie Hall, if you remember the movie, old women function as comic figures because their ugliness constantly reminds the leading characters of death. They pop up out of nowhere on the streets and say things like, love fades. You know, they say all these true things in the movie, but they're also caricatured as hideously ugly. They're supposed to invite the viewer scorn because they're so ugly. So much, you know, of what a young person does not want to turn into. And they have the only true lines in the movie. They're sort of anchors of authenticity simply as death heads. The disparity between the truth they speak and the palpable physical deformity which they exhibit is supposed to be comical. Woody Allen does not know what to do with the disparity because he knows these gals have got the truth, and he cannot take any pleasure in the thought of being a wizened, shriveled up old man. In his unreformed gaze, wizened, shriveled up geriatrics are simply ugly and repulsive. He cannot take any pleasure in seeing through the time tunnel to what he will look like in a few short years. For him, youth is immortality and age is death. And he does not need to be instructed which of the two is pleasurable and beautiful and which of the two is ugly. The truth is that beauty is not purely and simply objective. It's a matter of what we take pleasure in. So my second point is that beauty is indeed in the eye of the beholder. In some ways, it is a matter of taste, and there is Christian taste in beauty, and there is secular taste, and they're different. There is a truth in saying that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But that does not mean, the fact that tastes differ does not prove that there is no good taste or bad taste. The idea that beauty is in the eye of the beholder means that there is no such thing as beauty, just experiences of it, which are all different. I don't know if there is some one thing behind all experiences of beauty. Some people may be genuinely misguided and applying the wrong adjective to their experiences. Others may be colored, blind, or tone deaf. In that sense, beauty is not in the eye of the beholder. Some people have highly trained eyes, some people have untrained eyes, and others have eyes that are not only untrained but incapable of being trained very far. And the same goes for the rest of our physical senses. Some people are what Plato called amusicae, or lacking in music. Others have very weakly formed musical sensibility, which can be educated over many years to hear complex melodies. One has to be trained to become a wine taster. There is a delightful education in wine tasting that enables one to pick out lemon notes in one wine and to taste another wine evoking a giraffe frolicking on a pine-covered hill. Those of us who have not undergone this education of the palate can just about tell the difference between the produce of more than one country and an expensive vintage. If one is speaking of the deep down bottommost reality, we have to say that beauty is not in the eye of the beholder. Beauty is as objective and as singular as the god of whom it is a name. There is only one absolute divine beauty. That's true in theory. But in practice, dream on, Pseudo-Dionysus, because in the world we live in, there's a rioting, frolicking variety of tastes and beauty. In our human world, beauty has nowhere to live, except in the multiple blue, black, brown, green, hazel, squinty, round, and oval eyes of millions of beholders. That's where beauty lives, in the eyes of beholders. The great Thomist aesthetician Etienne Gilson, of whom I wrote a biography, he was a huge admirer of what was then called modern art, the non-figurative painting of the early 20th century. He figured that there is no way of convincing those who prefer figurative painting and want to see a horse painted like a horse, not with six heads and two legs, that figurative art can be as great or greater than art which emulates photography. Gilson said there's no way of convincing those who don't like non-figurative art that it is great art. He said so because it takes a certain kind of refined sensibility to appreciate what non-figurative art is doing. Gilson wrote, "In fact, all the arts rest on the aptitude of certain classes of sensible qualities to move our sensibility, or, if one prefers, on that of our sensibility to be touched by these sensibles. Those who are left indifferent by sound will never be interested in music, and the same remark applies to colors. Those who are left insensible by the simple perception of a pure tone will never take pleasure in any combination of colors there can be. And individual sensibilities to color are unequal. Someone with a mainly speculative mind cannot live in the company of painters nor read their writings without observing how much his own sensibility to chromatic sensations is inferior to theirs. Those who have a painter's eye, above all that of the colorist, ceaselessly experience pleasures and sometimes intense pain in the mere sight of colored objects around them, while common mortals assist at the spectacle without noticing it. It is thus easily understandable that some experience a vivid pleasure at the sight of pictures uniquely calculated in giving to the eye the type of pleasures which it prefers. One cannot blame those who do not experience it for expressing their disapproval of painting of this type." So you have to have the sensibility for it. Without the sensibility for it, you will never see it. Sensibility is not fixed, but sensibility is one of the givens of aesthetic appreciation. Most people do not have the taste for great art or great movies or great music. Their sensibility is simply untrained. At one time, when our educational system was still based on very ancient Neoplatonic models, education was thought to consist in attempting, so far as possible, to condition and improve the sensibilities of students. This model influenced me hugely when I first began teaching. And for many years, I was unshakable in my efforts to get students to read novels they had no taste for, and to watch movies for which they did not have the aesthetic sensibility to endure, let alone enjoy. Now today, even that kind of language of improvement of taste no longer makes very much sense to young people. I have given up on all but the great classics to move the imaginations of students. I do not force Tarkovsky upon undergraduates any longer, and I ask myself year by year whether it is really worth demanding that callow theology majors should enjoy Pasolini's Gospel According to Matthew. It is not that I have lost heart in my task as a teacher, but the truth of Gerson's statement is more and more forcibly borne in upon me. The sensibility is the core of it, and without the sensibility, there is nothing this person is going to enjoy. Most people do not have the sensibility for high art. Plato would not have disagreed. He would never have embarked upon mass education, as our Christian democratic culture has done. The truth is that people have different levels of aesthetic sensibility. That's the whole basis of the doctrine of the spiritual senses. Gerson thought that this fact about differing levels, kinds of sensibility, tended to be overlooked. It tended to be neglected. Because aesthetics, which was invented in the 18th century as the scientific study of beauty, is really more of an ideal abstract study of ideal types and ideal situations. Gerson thought that we need to make some distinction between different kinds of philosophical approaches to beauty. On the one hand, there is what he called callology. As Gerson defined it, callology is part of metaphysics. Its object is the beautiful as a transcendental of being. It is thus a department of ontology. Being as beautiful overflows the field of art. So there is callology, which studies the beautiful in its pure form, speculatively. On the other hand, there is the philosophy of art, which deals with the particular arts of the beautiful, like painting and music. And on the third hand, there is aesthetics, which Gerson himself thought is more of a subjective affair than the experts imagine it to be. Aesthetics really is tied up with subjectivity. Unless one begins by saying that aesthetics tends in reality to be a subjective matter, it's difficult to get any grasp on the notion of the spiritual senses. It would seem as if either one is a hermit in an icon and can smell spiritual perfumes, or one is not living inside a gold leaf painting and one can only see with physical eyes and smell with one's nose. So for this reason, it's a great shame that proponents of theological aesthetics often begin by talking about the transcendentals. They drone on about the transcendentals, truth, good, and beauty. They talk about the notion that beauty is a transcendental property of being. And this isn't about theological aesthetics at all. That's about theological callology, the science of the beautiful. Theological callology deals with the metaphysics of the transcendental named beauty. But a proper theological aesthetics would begin from the riot of diverse experiences which we human beings name as beautiful, from being knocked out by the smell of a perfumery to being bowled over by the beauty of an odoriferous old saint. Theological aesthetics should not begin by trying to prove that there's objective beauty. It shouldn't begin by arguing against the widespread fallacy that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It should begin by asking why such a riot of disparate experiences of beauty exist among us. Theological aesthetics should in fact insist that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. In order to be pleased by what pleases Christ and his saints, our senses have to be stripped, our hands must lose their grip. In order to be pleased by what pleases Christ, we need spiritual senses. Your experience actually has to be changed by Christ and changed utterly in order to find what he finds beautiful. So I turn now to my third point, which is that beauty is that which pleases when seen. So I hope you see my point, but I will just say it in this one third way. It's well known, I imagine all of you know, that Thomas Aquinas is said to have defined beauty as that which pleases when seen. pulcher est id quod visum placet. For many decades in the mid-20th century, Jacques Maritain, other such neo-scholastic figures, convinced readers that Thomas Aquinas had defined beauty as that which pleases when seen. Then along came Umberto Eco, who I think died a few weeks ago. Because, you know, Maritain didn't really read Thomas Aquinas all that carefully. Eco took another look at what Thomas Aquinas actually said. And Eco pointed out smartly that what Thomas literally wrote was pulcher dicuntur id quod visum placet. Beauty is called that which pleases when seen. So Umberto Eco, and I hope I will not speak ill of the dead, recent dead in this paper, Eco convinced very many people that Thomas Aquinas had not intended to define beauty. Rather, because he said dicuntur is called, Thomas Aquinas was making a sociological generalization about what people usually tend to describe as beautiful, because he said the beautiful is called that which pleases one sees. On Eco's view, Thomas was not defining beauty, he was simply telling us what people usually ascribe beauty to, whatever happens to please them. He's talking about the audience for beauty, about the people who experience beauty, not about beauty in itself. This means, by the way, that Thomas Aquinas was the first aesthetician, and he left calanology to the specialists of the 18th century. I used to find Eco's observation supremely annoying, and I was sure that if you run dicuntur through the online works of Thomas Aquinas, you would find thousands of instances of dicuntur all the way through, as if the whole metaphysics was a sociological generalization. It seems that Thomas Aquinas made thousands of sociological generalizations about everything and everywhere. At the summit of each of his five arguments for the existence of God, Thomas says, and this is what everyone calls God. Says dicuntur all the time. Thomas was interested in what everyone says, not because he was the world's first sociologist of religion, making sociological generalizations about how everyone the world over names God as the unmoved mover, the being which has necessity itself. Thomas uses the word dicuntur so often, in my opinion, not just as a casual tick, not in order to make sociological generalizations, but because he thought that reality sticks to the way we talk about things. It's because reality gets tangled up in the way we talk about things that it is more than sociologically interesting to say that we call beautiful those things that please us. The beautiful is, objectively, calanologically, that which elicits pleasure from people. So training one's aesthetic sensibility is learning to be pleased by more and more complex and beautiful objects. It could sometimes be passing from where we just take pleasure in simple colors and melodies, to where we could withstand spending 3 hours in an art film, totally revolves our sensibilities on every level, come out of the cinema and call it beautiful. Training one's aesthetic sensibility could sometimes be a matter of learning to call beautiful things which our simple, uneducated selves would say are highly unpleasant. The Platonic model of a simple hierarchy, where one rises from lower to higher pleasures, has not become untrue because we have a democratic model of education which makes it sound unpersuasive. It still has a lot of mileage in it. But at the same time, Plato never imagined that the higher sensibility can learn from the lower pleasures. And here I think he was wrong. When atonal music became regnant among highbrow composers, there was a tremendous outburst of creativity in popular music from Gershwin to the Beatles, which brought music back to melody and tonalities which people actually take pleasure in. The experience of beauty can never simply bypass pleasure in the most simple of ways. One of the most beautiful things I have learned over years as a Christian is to take seriously the tastes of simple people and to appreciate the vulgar aesthetic sensibility as a worthwhile bullshit detector. So spiritualizing the senses for a Christian cannot be a matter of replacing normal physical senses with spiritually highbrow senses, which can pick up sounds and smells to which our regular senses are deaf. Spiritualizing the senses is not a matter, or not simply a matter, of elevating the senses, although it can be. As you all know, in order for us to be pleased by what pleases Christ, our senses have to die with Christ and to be reborn with Christ. The doctrine of the spiritual senses is not a high-minded compensation for the repression of the material senses necessary to Christian discipleship. It is not saying you lose your senses, but don't worry, you get them back on a higher plane. Rather, it is saying your whole body must be surrendered to God. Conversion is not just a mental matter, but a complete revolution in the core of your being, in your stomach. Spiritualizing your senses is one way of raising them, but it is another sense of lowering them, being lowered into your body. Spiritualizing the senses is surrendering the senses to God, but surrendering the senses to the incarnate God, not to Plato's disincarnate ideals. It is surrendering one's senses to the incarnate beauty, not to disincarnate beauty. Spiritualizing the senses is a matter of embracing Christ as the object of our desires. Spiritualizing the senses is about being pleased by all things in which we see Christ and seeing Christ in all things. Spiritualizing the senses is not a matter of developing an elite Christian ascetic sensibility. It is not about joining a spiritual elite singing transcendental hymns around the throne. Spiritualizing the senses is a matter of putting on the mind of Christ with which to view reality, and being pleased by what pleases him. Spiritualizing the senses is tasting the fruits, the beverages which Christ enjoyed, and taking singular pleasure in them. Spiritualizing the senses is about experiencing enjoyment within the body of Christ. The ascetics of the spiritual senses is the ascetics of the body of Christ. Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Murphy will take some questions now.
How do we understand how to train aspiring artists to, or for that matter, merely connoisseurs of the arts to decipher the spiritual beauty in various works?
Oh, you're talking about looking at works of art. Are you talking about looking at works of art?
Well, I mean the artist as well as the viewer.
Well, I don't think the doctrine of the spiritual senses is about how to appreciate works of art per se. It's about how to experience the world, isn't it? It's about, I mean, you will find different kinds of works of art beautiful if you have spiritualized senses. But I don't think that it's about a training in art appreciation per se, except insofar as how you see the world affects how you see art.
If I could ask a follow-up question.
Sure.
I hope I'm not stepping out of my role here as moderator too much, but are you saying that a disordered soul will have disordered appreciations?
Yes. And the purpose of my talk is really that, I know I'm addressing the Thomas Circles and the Catholic Art Appreciation Society.
I'm sorry?
Well, addressing Thomas and people who are interested in Catholic art. I know we all believe very firmly in the objectivity of beauty and that it's really out there. And I wanted to just not to undermine that belief at all, but to go back to the fact that there is some truth in this notion that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And you really have to see that before you can see the doctrine of the spiritual senses. You know, we spend a lot of time fighting that notion that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, because we've got to have the objectivity of beauty. You know, it's these dreadful people who think it's all relativist. And so we've got to go out there and fight the relativists. You know, that's the battle. Fight the good fight against the notion that it's all a matter of taste, right? And so we spend a lot of our time doing this, those of us who are Thomists or von Balthasarians, those of us who do theological aesthetics. It's not all relative, you know, there is an objective beauty. And we spend much more time, but then how can you explain this doctrine of the spiritual senses? You have to say that the soul must be well ordered before it can see beauty, you know? And so that there is some genuine truth in this notion. And that's what I'm trying to get at in the three parts of my paper, in the sort of three ways of putting the same point. That the beautiful is that which pleases when seen, but who's looking? It matters who's looking, you see. Who says it? The beautiful is called. Well, who's calling, you see? And so we have to sometimes take our eye off the ball and say, well, actually, the experience does matter, and you're not going to experience the world as Christ experiences it unless you really put on the mind of Christ. You know, you won't see the beauty which God is inviting you to see unless you have a well-ordered soul. Yes. Yes, I think that I don't think there's any reason why you should. I mean, but I don't think that, in a way, I would have to say, you know, I don't think there's any reason why a Muslim ought to automatically find Christian art beautiful and appealing. Because the whole kind of aesthetic sensibility is trained in their faith, you know, and it's a different faith, and so the aesthetic sensibility trained within it is going to be completely different. And so let's go and show them a rat and we'll convert them. Well, good luck with that, you see. So you see, that's why I say simply this notion of the objectivity of beauty can't be the basis of theological aesthetics. Theological aesthetics is a bad experience, and it can't be experienced without belief. You see, belief is the basis of experience. That's what I'm trying to say. So that's that's why you have to train your sensibility, because you won't see beauty without a trained sensibility.
I think one way of looking at this that maybe resolves some of the tensions is not to put the emphasis on beauty per se, but that works of art are embedded values, and that if you respond to a work, you're responding to the values that you see in the work. So I was looking at the crucifix while you were speaking, and to respond to that is, if you value and honor the suffering of Christ and what it means, then you can respond. I think that that aesthetics has been greatly muddied by putting everything in terms of beauty, because when Baumgarten defined the term, he was speaking of cognitive experience, which encompassed many things. And even Kant, in the sections of where he's speaking about fine art and not about aesthetic experience in general, talks about aesthetic ideas. And the ideas are a whole range of things that people are concerned about. So I think if we can think of the response to art as a response to values, as opposed to beauty per se, then it helps to clarify a great deal. Does that make sense to you?
I shudder at the word value. Mm-hmm. I think of the value as kind of a substitute for reality. Mm-hmm. I mean, I agree with you about Baumgarten and Kant. I mean, this is part of what I'm trying to say, that they've got this strange objective notion of beauty which has nothing to do with experience. I don't remember it, but my little sister recently wrote her dissertation relating to Critique of Pure Judgment, and she says he doesn't describe any paintings at all.
She doesn't?
That Kant does not describe any paintings in the Critique of Pure Reason.
He doesn't, but he speaks about aesthetic ideas.
Yes.
And he talks about visions of heaven or hell.
Yes.
Or
yeah.
A spectrum of views of the world.
Yes.
Yes. And it seems, in my own working through these ideas, I have found it much more valuable to think in terms of certain ideas and values about the world that go beyond beauty. So
to me, value still sounds too intellectual, because you don't taste a value, you don't see a value.
No, it's an embodied value. You see Christ's suffering through the way it's embodied in the figure on the cross, which is why a crucifix is moving in a way that just the sign of the cross is not.
If you want to call beauty embodied value, I'm not going to argue with you, but to me the word beauty has a special thing. You know, it's about the form, the proportion, the whole thing. I mean, there's beauty, you know.
But that can be an abstract.
Yeah.
That can be an abstract.
Yeah. Is there another question? Yes.
Hey.
Who's supposed to be here?
I accept your question. Go ahead.
I've always traditionally understood that, or believed perhaps, that an encounter with beauty leads to conversion. But maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, what I heard from you, you were saying something like the opposite, as if we need conversion before we can experience beauty.
I said that it was a circle, but not a vicious circle. I said that the great moralists like Plato tell us that our minds and intellects ought to control our imagination, but those same moralists use images and allegories of great beauty to urge us to use our intellects to control our imagination. So there is a sort of there's this whole thing of like the circle of truth, goodness and beauty chasing each other. You've got images which control what you can value and what you do and what you think. And at the same time, you're not going to find certain kinds of things beautiful unless you think certain things. So the three are chasing each other, you see. I don't say that you have to find the thing beautiful before, you know, you have to believe in Christ before you can find him beautiful. I mean, he shows himself to you, and by the light of grace, you can see his form. Only by the light of grace, which he shines upon himself, you see his form, and in seeing his form at all, you see it as beautiful. So to see him is to see him as beautiful. And that's just simply a conversion. Seeing Christ as beautiful, the moment you see Christ as beautiful is the moment of conversion. But without conversion, you can't see him as beautiful. His form doesn't come together at all without conversion. He could be a magician or a Jewish rabbi or whatnot. There's all these bits and pieces that biblical scholars make of him. So for his form to come together as a whole at all, he has to hold it together. He has to shine that light of grace on himself and show himself to you. He spotlights himself to you and shows himself to you as a form. And that form is beautiful. It's embodied value, if you want to call it that, or it's beautiful, because it makes sense. But it doesn't make sense otherwise, without the light of grace that he shines on himself.
One more question.
It seemed to me that you were talking about the hermit as having sort of the ideally developed sense of spiritual sense, and then there's our sort of mundane or earthy experience. And it occurred to me when you painted him, I guess literally, into an icon, whereas a hermit's real lived existence is in a rustic setting, subject to the cold, the warmth, bland food or wonderful food. And so in a, it seems to me that, I mean, it doesn't happen very often, but sometimes washing dishes can be a prayer, or a really good glass of beer, which they have in Norfolk, is a spiritual experience.
Yes, I tried to get to this towards the end, that spiritualizing the senses can be physicalizing the senses. I tried to say that towards the end. I didn't want to say spiritualizing the senses is physicalizing the senses, because that's just saying, well, integrate yourself. You know, embodiment is beautiful. That isn't simply a Christian message. You know, spiritualizing the senses can be elevating the senses, or it can be physicalizing the senses. It depends on how Christ wants you to experience him here and now.
I mean, it's all tied up in the incarnation.
That's correct.
Spiritual and
yes,
physical.
That's right. Spiritualizing the senses is getting grounded in the senses. And so the hermit is more grounded in senses. I mean, that's the whole point of purgation, isn't it? It's a point of penance. Is that you get more grounded in the senses, not less, because you notice more. Yeah.
Okay. I think that's all we have time for. Thank you very much.